Welcome everybody to this workshop. I will talk. Title is Inbuilt Musicality, and I will talk address building instruments with Yoshimi. We have actually two workshops covering Yoshimi this year, and the next one will be tomorrow by Will. And so our two workshops will kind of be complementary. You will be oriented towards live playing and live music making, and I have a different angel, because mine is rather a project, building a project, building music instruments, and then it's rather oriented towards composition and something which you do with MIDI and not necessarily play live. The final goal is to render it with MIDI and to get a nice sounding result. So, okay, as a kind of a motivation, of a lengthy historical motivation, I'll start my introduction with a kind of a fairy tale. So let's start like a very fairy tale with, yeah, once upon a time and a long time ago in the galaxy far, far away, there was an glorious avant-garde movement. An avant-garde movement called electronic music. So these were very, very serious, very gifted people, the best of the best of the best, and imagine them, people in white coats in a laboratory with lots of wires and constructing. And it was a trend to depart from the worn out musical tradition to create a new music, a music which has new expressive means, which is a new way for the composer directly to address the public, and so on. And then somehow someone invented sampling. And soon thereafter, the conquering of new frontiers, the revolutionary movement was all but forgotten. And just come in. And so that might be the cautionary part of the tale. Sometime thereafter, in fact, we do make our music electronically. We make our music with computers, almost entirely with computers. But we do that electronic music now, we do it with conditioned captured of real instruments, which are grid aligned to a drum machine. So that's the end of the story. And now, well, we somehow lost that avant-garde. It's gone, it's past. So we cannot just reinstate the past and continue with an avant-garde, but we can try to draw from some of those ideas. We try to make them future ideas again. And one of those ideas which always enticed me is the idea to build an synthetic instrument. That was one of the ideas. And well, to build a synthetic instrument, for one, what means synthetic? Yes, it's quite obvious for us. We use computers, we use some means of electronics, we use computers, but the basic idea is that we create the sound from scratch. We do not use some kind of capturing, we build it from scratch. So the rather difficult question with all of this is, what is a music instrument? That's the more difficult, it's more somehow evades us when we, what is a music instrument? What makes some device a music instrument? So, well, we could approach that in a bold way. Let's just put it under controlled conditions, put the musician also under controlled conditions, and then investigate what's the features of a music instrument. Now, the funny thing is, if you take that approach, yes, that's assumed to be a music instrument, but it just doesn't seem right that way. You can discern a lot of features here. Jetzt ist clear, but somehow it sounds somehow weird, strange, interesting in some way, but it's just not what is the idea of a music instrument which we get under those controlled conditions. Especially if what we understand with a music instrument sounds this way. And so on. You see, that is assumed to be the same instrument, the oboe. But it's with the first tone, it's entirely different. There is something which I would like to call a musical context. Even after the first note, there's an accompaniment which sets a stage. Moreover, we perceive something like an air, an spaceness. It's also a sense of distance. And it's moving. So this highlights some of the obstacles we are facing here. And I think one of the main obstacles we are encountering is that we have a commonplace standard theory how to think about musical sound. And this standard theory is like that we have, it's based on the idea of a sonic event. A sonic event is a has a well-defined temporal property, a starting point, it has an extension, and it has a well-defined frequency. So that's kind of all is set. And then it's modeled like along the idea of content and the container. The content is a spectral content, and the container is an envelope, the ADSR envelope. And that's the basic model we have in mind. And in fact, it's a quite enticing model because it's a model which is well suited to construct instruments. It's quite simple, it's quite straightforward. And if you follow that model, it's basically somehow sounds like music and you can play it. You can build MIDI systems. You can build synthesizers based on that model. So it's geared toward that act of making something, of building something. But it's woefully inadequate if we want to use that theory to understand what music is, to look at the phenomena which make music. Then this theory, so it may be correct in a mathematical sense, but the fun fact is that the theory can be correct, but still miss the point. And so what we should do here is we should not just reject that theory, but we should understand that it is a theory for building technical devices, and we can use it. We can use the technical devices to get a fresh angle on existing music, because just by the basic properties of that theory, the Fourier transform, we have a really great tool for looking at music in a way we never could, in all the centuries, we never could do before. So we can now sensually perceive music in a different way by looking at the spectrum, and we can look at the waveform and try to match that with the phenomena we perceive when we look at music. So here I have the spectrum analyzer, and let's just listen to a piece of avant-garde music, of course. Where am I? So volume down, loud piece. So yes, it's avant-garde music, because you might be smiling now, it's old music, it's Renaissance. That's wrong. you need to understand that. Just come in. You need to understand that most of our Occidental music tradition has that avant-garde trait. That was a defining trait for the music, the trend to depart from a tradition, to break with the tradition, to get back to the direct music. That's a defining trait which makes up the Occidental music and always gave a new impulse to it. You see, there's a commonplace music which we share with all cultures, a kind of musicality, the ritual use of music. But this is one of the defining traits, that to make rules, to break rules. And so for that reason, yes, it's an avant-garde piece. But we want to look to the sonic properties. Let's start it and look at the... yeah. Okay, so we should. Thanks for the tip. So you can, that's the most important part, you can see the diagram. Okay. So what's most striking here? Yes, what's most striking here by the with the sound is that that current character of richness, of abundance, which is typical of the excess abundance and air, which is typical for musical instruments. Now, if you want to look in more and more at on the waveform, so can you see that waveform? So I need always try to be more on the left side. Okay. So there is this flowering, uplifting element, and if we want to look in here and get more of it, we may set a loop and loop it. The first thing is, if we use looping, we sharpen our perception, because repetition creates a preconception, and we learn to listen to perceive more and more and more. Just come in. To listen, perceive more and more with every repetition. We can try to zero in. But if the basic idea is that we want to get somehow at the features of that music, we can try to loop it more tightly, and then something interesting happens. If we loop it more tightly. So now, with the act of looping, we have created an additional element, an artifact, a new sonic element, which stems from the regularity of the loop, and we added it. And it's kind of gets between what we hear and what is in the music. Of course, we can say we need to do it just better, if we are doing it wrong or in a bad or the uneasy way. So let's increase the crossfades to make it more smooth and so on. So you see, there's even in the tiny part is still some moving a pulsating part drin, which, but the other thing is, we have already lost almost all of the freshness and the liveliness and the abundance of this. It's gotten kind of sterile. And if we go through this process to the end and make it really so that it's a steady state in accordance to the model, basically we have lost all which is lively on that sound. And that's the takeaway from that first demonstration. Yeah. Just come in. Hopefully we have some some chair left, so otherwise... Oh, this one. Yeah, just take my backpack here away and... Okay. So yes, that was the first takeaway from that observation. And let's do another example. Another example. Now I'll take a little bit different musical category, and I take a piece of a pipe organ, a church organ. And the defining trait for why I choose that piece is it's the start of the piece, and it's basically just one key, one musical key, a starting key, and. Okay, so here starts the piece. Let's loop that and listen to that. So the first thing which is quite striking if we look at it more closely, we see there is some regularity, but if we look precisely, we won't find any two identical oscillations here. Every one, single one, is different. So that's just this just breaks away the floor below us, because our theory, we have a steady state, we have frequency, and the prerequisite for that is that you have something really periodic. You need to have some two things which are identical, so you can define the notion of an oscillation, of a frequency, of a wavelength. But if you look at that music, so the next thing is we it's not entirely irregular, but it's also not also entirely regular. We see some kind of structure going on, some kind of microstructure. In an intuitive way, we can, after some time looking at such diagrams, we can even make some connections with what we see here and what we hear here. It's also, if we look at the spectrum diagram, we can make up some features, of course. Those microstructures are on the brink of just being perceptible by themselves. We can just barely perceive them as some kind, as a grainy nature. And that was also brittle and grainy nature. And also that's somehow that kind of freshness which is in the sound. And probably many of you know already of Denis Gabor, of the great researcher who later invented, he was always enticed by that graininess, well, of the sound and later of the light, and as some of you knew, later he invented holography and became the Nobel Prize for it. But Denis Gabor, basically he founded that what I told you here, namely that the classical theory is some way misguiding us, and that we need another theory. And built on the basic building block should be that grainy nature, that microstructures, which he called sonic grains. And so there is, each of these grains is a unit in itself. It has already some spectral color, and as he said, it's our most basic understanding, basic experience, that music has as well a temporal pattern as a sonic spectral pattern at the same time. So there is, and that's what we are seeing here, there is some kind of patterning and structuring going on, but there is constant change. There is never something repeated, it's constantly going on. And another thing which I think is worth mentioning here, if we look at that, this. You hear those tiny elements going on here. Dun. It's already the left hand of the organ player playing the first pieces of the score. So you see there is a sonic a single sonic event or sonic happening, which is unfolding and changing, and while it is unfolding, there is already the musical context going on. And even more, if you listen more carefully and sensually, the player even aligns to the sonic event. You see there is some breathing qualities. The initial start, the sound goes in, then it reduces, then it swells again, and it goes with the second wave. And by that second wave, the player enters the main line of the score. Ja, come in, come in, come in. Come in. Come in, yes, yes, this is a seminar, just come in. I don't know if you have some chairs left. Yeah. Okay, so the point where I was, there is some, the musical part is going on here, and the player aligns to what happens sonically. Let's just listen to that again. I think he does it subconsciously. It's not an intellectual thing of the player, of the musician to do that. It's rather a subconscious thing. But for us, the important thing is that the categories of sound and sonic and of music, of musical context overlap. You cannot say it's a hierarchy. You build up things from building blocks, but it's there at the same time. The sonic, the spatiality, the air which is there, also the room. You cannot separate the instrument from the room. And it's all there at the same time. And what's very important, the musical context. We have those tiny little things which we hear as parts of the score, but there are other elements like this here, which we have no problem to discern just as an effect, as an element of the quality of the sound. So we can do this because we bring a musical context with us. We know it's an organ piece, we know it's a piece of the 19th century, we hear that after some, we immediately realize it, and so those elements, those constant transitions which are there, create the context, but can only perceive with the context. So it's a closed loop. It's a closed loop. So I think that were the first takeaways from which we can take from looking at this musical phenomena. So that brings me to the goal which I have to the project. It's a kind of a project. I said we build electronic instruments, synthetic instruments. We want to understand what makes an instrument an instrument. So what are the qualities of musicality, and we build on the techniques and technologies of sound synthesis. So basically, there are some well-researched algorithms which create more, less sterile, more vivid, more moving sound. They are well-researched. So the first idea would be take some synthesis language, C sound. In my case, it would be SuperCollider. Collect those algorithms. Maybe code some. I'm a coder, I can code, so I could code some, code it up, build a workbench configuration for myself. And then at some point I thought, well, it's a huge project, it's an interesting project, but why not just try out a very good existing soft synthy? And that happened to be Yoshimi, and you introduced me to Yoshimi in Mainz, and I immediately said, oh, that's basically, that must be it. It's, and I looked at it, yes, it has already the most important algorithms built in. It has them as modules with a basically sensible wiring of modules and parts. And so the very enticing part is the infrastructure work is already done. You can save parameters, you can tweak parameters. There's even a GUI, yes. You do not have to code parameters, you can tweak them live. Even elements of MIDI addressing are controllers and that kind. Of course, there are limitations. We are dealing limitations in if we use an existing element program. That's clear. because it's hardwired. If I use a synthesis language, I have a vision, I say I have to wire them so, I know it's I need to do it that way, I can't just do it. But when I use an existing program, an existing system, I'm confined to the wiring operations and rewiring operations and just what's there. And when the author or the software has not thought on some possibility, I need to find a workaround. And indeed, it was, I had to find quite some workarounds for problems. And there are some limitations where I think where we are hitting the limits of the thing. But it's still enticing to just to create a preset, just to create that this electronic instrument as a preset, which is on a well-settled platform where I can rely on that it stays the same. When I put weeks or months of work in such a preset, it's very important that it stays the same, that I can rely on it sounding the same 1 year ahead or in the next version, and that I can share it, that I can share it with other people can play those instruments. All of that would be not so trivial if we just built it with a synthesis language. And so that's the reason why I just stuck to Yoshimi and went into that. And of course, I will tell you some of my findings, insights, and the insights I'm presenting are basically wider than the specific music I like or someone else likes, because they are rather oriented toward what makes an instrument musical. So don't let you say tricked by the kind of music I try. Someone likes it, someone don't like it. But what I tell you is wider in scope. So there's a basically, if we say okay, we use Yoshimi, we use that synthi, we build instruments, then we have a path traced ahead of us. Because it is a synthi, it is based on that construction theory. It has MIDI events. It has a spectral content. It has an envelope. So we have to start from that basically static part, and we have to pave our way. The first step would be to get good spectra. How to make good spectra which are well suited for musical playing. Listening is one thing, and then the next thing would be to work on the envelopes and try to get that kind of dynamics in and to transform them and enrich them. So the first thing, and I will kind of walk with you that path and show you some of the introductory some examples what you can do. Maybe you can take away some inspirations what you can do to shape and mold sound as you go. So the first part is that we look at cover that we look at the spectral side of things and what we need to understand to build spectra and to shape spectra for musical sound. Now, again, we build on that theory. That theory tells us sound is composed of sine oscillations and of a series of sine oscillations, a regular arithmetic series. So we should just keep that in mind. We don't know if those partials are there as phenomena or if they just are there as an artifact of the analysis. And the interesting part is, in fact, both can happen. We have cases where a partial really appears as a musical phenomenon and is apparent and has a character. And we have other situations where we can just look at the spectrum diagram. We see some loop dancing partials or the spectral lines. But in fact, it's just the artifact of the moving sound, which is not captured in the theory. So there are, in fact, some partials which are well-defined and which appear on a musical scale, and I want to go through them with you. And let's listen to some of them. So the first thing, now it comes a little bit tricky because I need to keep it at that point. So the first thing is we have a simple sine function here. No, not yet. I tell you. So in this Yoshimura Synapp sub, we have three modules, the additive synthesizer, the subtractive synth, and the pad synth, which is a kind of a granulator. It's a granulator which works on a spectral level by back transformation. But first we look at the additive synthesizer. And you see here's the sine waveform. And yes, yes, yes. Can you see it this way? Yes, there's the sine function. And here we get an editor. If we click on the waveform, we get an editor where we can really mix in the individual partials. Mm-hmm. Aha, cool. Okay, thanks. Thanks. So it should be on the upper side. Yes, okay. So that is the fundamental frequency. Maybe I should fill in some bits of theory. I don't know if everyone is aware of that, but just recap, we have sine functions. We built a sequence of sine functions in the Fourier analysis. It's an arithmetic sequence. So we have the fundamental frequency, then we take two times that frequency, three times that frequency, four times. We determine the coefficient for each of them, and we build that sequence to gradually approach a tone. So that's the basic idea. And so we get those sequences with even numbers. And this is also known as the natural sequence because they are in a tone relation. Yeah, please play it. I would start with the C. This were a foundation. Then the next tone would be an octave. Then the next tone would be a fifth. The next octave. Then the major third, the upper fifth, and the seventh, and the eighth partial. So each partial has also a musical relation, and in fact, you can regenerate some of the rules of the scores and the keys and the tuning by, for example, by taking the relation between the second and the third partial. So they are in a relation of 2 to 3. That's the relation which defines the major fifth. It's a pure relation. So if you play that, you see it in the diagram. It's not beating. It's completely stable. There are other intervals which are beating, which are not entirely pure. But that's a very complex theoretical topic. That's the reason of these partials, and I personally prefer the partial numbering. Some people define the fundamental and then the overtones. I prefer the partial numbering. It's easier to recognize. So the first is the fundamental. That's that. And now I'll add the first, what I call a character overtone. That's the octave, the second. It's, if you play a little bit for me.
Something.
Incidentally, that's Gabriel Wolf. I'm very happy he joined the team very shortly. He's way, way better on the keyboard than I am. So, okay. So at some point, you perceive that there is something additionally fair, and some point even it breaks apart. You perceive there are two parts in the sound, but there's a point where the partial is rather subliminal. It just changes the coloration.
Just play one note.
Yes, yeah. Just one note. You need to hit it several times. Again. You see, it's emerging step by step, and it changes the color. It's quite common to compare the colors with the colors in painting, and I would say that the characteristic color of the octave of the second partial is white. It's lighting the sound. It makes the sound lighter, and it's like in painting. You know, white is a color and is not a color. Sometimes white can be a color on itself. In other cases, it's just that presence of lightning. brightening the sound. And the interesting part is, if I add the next octave, it's the same.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't hear it very well. Could you repeat and overdrive this overtone maybe so I can separate them?
Yes, I try. Yes. I do it with the fourth partial. Okay, please play. Here it's there. And here it submerges. A technical note at that point. Can you see that here? Yes, here is a scale, which means what it's the scale used for the sliders here. And linear means that it's that the interesting part where the partials just submerge is quite down. So it's good for mixing strong colors, but fortunately we have scales which are logarithmically and more oriented towards the lower tones. And it's way easier to shape the sound fine grained if we go to the lower scales. Please play it again. So we get in the interesting region where you can start shaping the sound. And start playing with the coloration. Sometimes you have even to go to the 100 dB scale. Yes. Because here you get that kind of fine-grained. Usually you go up until you perceive it. And then you lock with your perception on it. And then you let it fall down. That's the interesting point to work with it. Okay, so that was basically the first partial. And as you already said, it's a family. Because it repeats in octaves, every partial is the foundation of a family of partials. So the next one, which I use, so I reset it to the... Yeah? Oh. Please use the microphone, so it's on the video. It's on. It's just for the taping of the people.
So the slides that you show with the like an octave, etc. Mm-hmm. How does it relate to the sliders? I expect that the second one is an octave above, but I'm not sure about the rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll tell you what the. So I just reset. We are back to pure sine. So the first is an octave above. Voice parameters. Get it in here. And maybe before we start, we play again the natural sequence. So that's the foundation. The second partial is an octave in the musical key of an octave. And the third partial is a fifth. But it's three times that is two times the frequency, that is three times the frequency. It just happens to work out that way. So it's also kind of phenomenon that it works out that way. And then it's, this is explaining your question. So basically it's kind of the other way around. There is that natural sequence, then people folded in those intervals like that of the 2-3 interval and made that a musical interval. This was the historical way of finding. So let's talk a bit about the third partial, which is the fifth. Yes, play it. Now you hear it's actually it's a duodecim, it's an octave in the fifth above. But you clearly hear the fifth nature, which you a musician recognizes it. So okay, we need to go down to a scale where we can actually adjust it properly. Yes, please play. Here it comes. To move it out. really, it's a different different quality, a different coloring that what we get here. Again, I repeat it with the, again, the sequence, the doubled, so I have the third, and then the sixth is again an octave above of the quint, so it's, that would be the third, and that would be the sixth, okay? Again, it's a kind of color. I wouldn't call that color white. Yeah, please come in. Please come in. I wouldn't call that color white. It makes some has a quality of ampleness. It makes it soft. And in at high volume, it makes it powerful and whiteful. But it's not that kind of brightness and whiteness which the octaves give. Just play it again.
May I
repeat
something
you
said before?
Yeah.
The effect is the most. It's most effective when the loudness of the overtone is just barely when you perceive the second. Mm-hmm.
Then it's most effective as a color. The organ builders sometimes go a little bit farther so that you even can perceive it, but it still works as a color. Please play it. So the organ builders sometimes go even to that level. Can you play a little bit musically? In that, the organ builders call that high fifth. The French call it the larijo. The tears is the third, and the larijo is the fifth. And it's yes, okay. Please. That's a kind of organ sound. Another takeaway is you perceive the coloring quality better if you play it in a musical context. Then if you play individual tones, it becomes more obvious, the coloring quality becomes more obvious if you play it in a musical context. So okay, that was the fifth. And again, we have sequences, we have a family of higher fifths, we have the same coloring. Okay, then the next one I want to cover. So that's kind of algebraic structure. You know that also of the square roots or of the prime numbers, and the low numbers, they are quite dense, and then come the repetitions and they come scarcer and scarcer. And so it here is also, we have the second, the third. Now we skipped the fourth because it's an octave, and the next one interesting one is the fifth, which is a major third of the musical interval. So that's musical interval. Now please play again a musical piece. So you see it's a different color. I would call it it's kind of brown, warm, sweet, sometimes also a little bit brittle. It's not that straight and sincere nature of the fifth. The fifth can be sparkling. It's just more earth-like, grainy, the nature of the third. Also, you use the tenth partial again, the high. And the organ builders, for example, like to combine that with the fifth. So let's play that. And if we add a skeleton of octaves with that, then we get a kind of a horn-like quality. In fact, in many organs, there is a register which is made up of five pipe ranks playing together. That's the cornea. It's even banked up behind the prospect of the pipes to have and this very, very distinct organ-like quality. And it's an imitation of a reed instrument which is made of five ranks. An octave, the low, it's, let's just make it up. We can do it here. It's a nice thing. And the third, yes, play it. You know the sound, yes? So you see colors mix. It's like in painting, the mix, the ampleness of the fifth and the sweetness and the warmth of the third mix. Yeah, a question.
What about reverb? What if we remove the reverb when we hear the dry
sound? We can do that, yes.
Because I believe we reverb that a lot of color.
Yes. Let's remove it. So the question was just if to what degree does reverb add coloration? Because reverb typically adds some kind of coloration, and what is if we watch the dry sound? So again, we have the same instrument.
For me to play the same again.
You then play something different.
Okay, it doesn't matter what.
Yeah. Yes, but the point I want to make is it transforms.
Yeah.
It transforms, and often it's, for example, especially with pipe organs, it's the way that the sound, which is intended in a musical way, only appears through that transformation. So that the colorful quality, which I showed you, really only appears if you have the instrument plus the room. So I think it's not the right approach to think as a coloration because the room is also part of the instrument in the same way as the foundation or the spectrum we put in. But you are true, you are right. There are rooms which add a real coloration or distort the sound or make it shape it in a way that it's bad to play it or hard to play it musically. So there are reverberation which supports the musicality, and there are other which adds coloration or makes it fuzzy or that way. Of course, I'm using here just a preset of which is not the bad, not the worst here, but it's just a freeware preset, and you can do much better if you use impulse responses or the like. Is just to show you. Let's play it again with the reverb. Thank you. So the point was here the combination to the reverb, that's right. It just mixes it to the degree that the overtones don't stick out. If we remove the reverb here, I would say the level of the overtones, it sounds nice, still nice, but I would say they are too high. They are not so much blended here. Yes, you hear them separate. Yes. Of course, it's a matter of taste, and it's a matter of the question what you want to achieve and what you say. That's the sound. That's the vision I have. I want to go for. So, but
it's
yes,
it's easier to understand what you're saying. So, for example, just for the purpose of demonstration, I'm not saying you have to perform that way, but when you're explaining it, it's easier.
Yes. Okay. So I put away the reverb, and we have still to cover some of the fundamental colors. We have left two. Namely, the next interesting one is the seventh, which just by coincidence also happens to be the seventh partial. So please play it. So I think it was quite striking. It's often called a wood-like quality. You know it from the xylophone. It has a warm quality, but somewhat brittle. Yes, chord. Yes, play it short. To show you what happens, I add an envelope here. And the important point is I add lower the sustain and make it quite. Now you notice the xylophone-like quality. If I try it. Yes, yes, yes.
I have to play it differently.
Yes.
Like, it feels differently.
Yes. But that's a very important point, is that feedback loop. The musician is part of the game. If you change the spectrum, if you change the quality, he will play it differently. He will perceive it differently under the fingers. So, okay. So, I think that was quite striking, that quality. And it now to cover the last one, that's the ninth, which also by a coincidence happens to be the ninth partial, so it's easy to remember. So please play it. So it's had a little as kind of glistening quality. It's rather metallic, a little bit of fairy dust quality. You can easily overdo them. It's very dangerous because you might like them, and it's easy to get astray to do too much with the thirds, with the sevenths, with the ninths. But they are very powerful tools. And the interesting thing is that's basically all of them. The higher partials don't add some really new qualities. They are quite, if you take the 11, they're quite similar to the ninth. I used the 11. Little bit different. Mm-hmm. But it's also that glistening metallic, it becomes all more or less the same with the higher partials. And that's an interesting point. So those partials which act as individualities are just a few colors, and you use that's your palette, and then you mix. But the higher partials have a different kind of nature, because the higher partials work in combination. When once you add the higher partials, it's more a patterning of them working together, which shapes what I call an archetype of a general image of the spectrum. So the lower partials are individual characters. They play a part in a larger building, which is the spectrum overall. And the higher partials, which can be a lot and which can be filled in, and then what matters is rather the overall patterning and how they move together. And I just go to the presentation for a moment. We have covered all those points now. And the next one is which I call spectrum archetypes, just as a rough categorization. In the same way as we have the partials, we have the spectrum. Spectrums can have a fundamental kind of trend. which is a Klanggestalt. It is quite distinctive, and you immediately recognize it. And it's we can link it to a specific kind of patterning. And the first one I want to mention is the fundamental dominated. It's basically just using the foundation with a little bit of the other overtones for filling in, for lightening it, for balancing it, but basically everything lines up behind the fundamental. So it's not so important because it doesn't create much delineation. You can use it as a solistic instrument, but the point is the more partials you add to a spectrum, the more clearer it becomes, the more clearer becomes the contour. Of course, you can overdo it, but it becomes clearer to trace a line in a complex score with a voice which has lots of partials. So, of course, the obvious next one is a flute-like. So let's use our flute. Just a second. Yeah, it's on channel 3. Mm-hmm. Last moment, I have reduced the reverb. Can you now please hit the single key in the melody octave? A little up, the G, yes, and hold it. You see, there is a small number. For flute-like spectrum, there is a small number of character overtones. Just a small number. The fundamental is still dominating, but the others are present at the point that's perceptible, but go into a hole with it. Also, there is a common vibrato or oscillation at LFO, which unites the instrument. Okay, play it again. Yes, thank you. For example, we can also just look at a piece of music. Should use the loop so we can look at the spectrum. You can see quite clearly that the flutes, when the flutes come, the limited spectrum gets up over the floor, which is built by the strings. Okay, I think that's enough. So that's the flute-like, and then of course we have what's always a kind of the opposite of the flute-like spectrum, that's the string-like or bowing spectrum. So, well, now that's the point where it starts difficult with synthesis instruments, because flutes you can build, it's easy to build a flute, but it's damn hard to build a string. So basically, actually we cannot make it with pure additive synthesis. We need other methods like granulation or subtractive synthesis, then we get into a roughly in a string-like quality. Can we maybe close the door, because it's irritating for me that we have to listen carefully. So I play a little bit of strings. It's not loud, it's rather gentle. I've just frozen the spectrum so you can look at it. One thing which we notice here is that the lines are widened. That is due to the chorus effect. We have a chorus of strings playing in an orchestra, and that just together, works together with the room and the delays and the reflections to create a widening of the lines. The other thing we need to watch is how they dance, how they move. You can see there is some seem to go together, but they are not going together as a whole. I think it's rather a tightly interwoven pattern of several structures going partially in. Okay, so that's the. I think it's quite clear to everyone. It's a fundamental archetype of spectrum, flute-like, the string-like, this tightly interwoven. The interesting point: if a spectrum goes denser and denser, it can become sharp, but it must not become sharp. So there are still different ways to go. If you add too much to it, it just becomes sharp. But the interesting point is when we go other ways, like the strings are quite filled in, but they are patterned in a relatively complex structure, and we can emulate that with kind of randomness. In the real music, it is not random, but we can quite well emulate it with randomness. And then there's another spectrum type, which rather shows up in large sounds, in orchestras, and like I like to call it the radiant sound. It's difficult to show it for me. It's quite difficult because in the recording, those tend to get sharp. I did a lot of recording. The experience is, if you listen to it in the hall, it's clear it has this bright radiant quality. And if you listen it in the mix with spot mics, it tends to get sharp or noisy. So I use some beats of an orchestra. Oh, sorry, bit too loud. Here. Sorry, jumped to the wrong point. I'm interested in that quality, which shows up in the middle here, that after the first punch. That would be the quality which I like to term radiant quality. You know, it's from large orchestras, especially when the brass adds, but not too sharp, not too much punch. And I don't know really what's the patterning, but it seems to me in comparison with the strings. Yes, here in that piece, I think some of you will have recognized the piece. But the nice point is, you have here that punches, and then you have the strings. So you have the direct comparison of those two. Recognize the string pattern here. Now we have a noisy floor by the timbres. We have the flute-like adding out. I think that's enough. I can just say it's an interesting pattern. It's very, very, very hard to get with synthetic instruments, but it's there. And then the other one is just noisy. Of course, noisy is a catch-all category, because there's not one kind of noise, there's a thousand kinds of noise. So that was the basic archetypes, and I need to get a bit, little bit ahead because I have still to show you something. But first, I'd like to to cover some further important parts of the spectral patterning, and that is a spectrum is a complex entity, and that complex entity moves. If we play musical scores, it moves through several registers, through several levels. And the point is, the spectrum is always there, but our hearing capabilities are limited. We have a window which we can perceive very well, and we have other points which we cannot perceive so well, not so clear. And so if we move a given spectrum over the whole musical area, we will perceive only a larger or a smaller window of that spectrum, and that changes the way we perceive it. So basically, if you build a spectrum, you encode into that spectrum several programming surveys how it should behave in that area and how it should behave in that area. And I want to demonstrate that. We use, just a second, we use the number 7, the channel number 7. So that's a rather a read. Can you hear it? I should add the level here up again. Yeah. So it's a rather reed-like instrument, and first I would ask you to play it in the melody range. So we have the melody range, that's the one line octave, that's where the D string of the violin is, and where the sound of the tuning fork is, that's the melody level above C4 is. Yes. So basically here we see the first collection of overtones, the first 12 overtones or so. We see them together, playing together, but not much more. Thank you very much. So we have already something to work with. We have that balancing of overtones. We have with 12 overtones or so, you can do a lot, and you basically set the stage. That's the fundamental character of the voice is there. Now, if we move up one octave to the, yes? And up, more up. So it's just basic math. If we have a higher bass frequency, the spacing of the overtones becomes larger. So that means you have greater gaps and you have a smaller number of overtones to work with. So, and that the reason is, that's the reason why in the higher levels, all instruments become more and more similar. They become sharp and pipe-like, and you have less opportunities to shape them or to change them. So yes, there's a question. Yes, give the mic, please, back. Mm-hmm. Yes. You have a band limit with the Nyquist frequency, and you have a cutoff, and you can only in the digital. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, it does not become larger, because here the scale is linear. Also, that's a good point. The scale is linear here, and actually we should be using a logarithm scale. So here, that would be one octave. 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 So in musical keys, the tones are also spread in linear frequency, spread farther apart. So it does not, if you actually do the scale, use a logarithmic scale, which rather resembles the way of the octaves, there is no spreading of the frequencies out. But the other thing is, we do have some hearing apparatus, and it has limited capabilities. It has just some of the hearing hairs, and if you get older, the highest hearing hairs die off. So that's the limiting factor. You hear less and less. I wouldn't say it's just strictly cut at 20 kilohertz. So that's because, as we said, that as we saw, the sine functions are only one part of the picture. The waveform is another part, and what you perceive is rather a rattling of beatings in the ear. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, we are less sensible. It's not, you're completely right. It's not because the overtones are more spread. I want just to say them by the basic math, they are spread farther out, and the higher overtones move to frequencies which are outside of the range which we can perceive so clear. That's the reason. And for that reason, what makes a strong perception are just some overtones are left, and most of them move out. And that makes the sound thinner and less distinct. The resolution. Mm-hmm. I think it's exactly that way. In the low basses and in the very high highs, the resolution of our hearing capabilities is not so distinctive as in the middle range. Now let's move to there's another question.
This might be a very stupid question, but I want to ask it anyway. I was wondering about undertones. Mm-hmm. Because, well, the highest we go, we should hear them mm-hmm. more.
The difference frequencies are undertones, yes?
Yes. And so are there possibilities for us to make them more evident, more easy to hear with the tools that you're presenting here?
Yeah. I don't know what's the actual stand of the science, but there was a debate of if the undertones.
Yes, that's why I'm asking, actually. Yeah, yes.
I do not want to position myself because I realize the scientists are still split into two camps. One say they are kind of a physical phenomenon. The other says the undertones, the difference frequency, are just a perceptive phenomenon. So the physical camp says there's some intermodulation and this excites another oscillation. And the perceptive camp says you have a patterning in mind and you add in the missing foundation if the rest of the pattern fits. That's the two camps regarding the undertones.
Okay.
Yes.
Like maybe add some just one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
You may maybe remember the waves plugin MaxBass. MaxBass, it adds overtones to simulate more.
Deeper.
Deeper bass is not there, but the brain or the hearing system adds this tone virtually.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Then we have the acoustic sub bass in the organ, in the pipe organ. If the church is not large enough to accommodate a 32 feet, which is 10 meters long, then you can use the fifth and the octave, which is shorter, to kind of create the same sense of bass groundedness, which you cannot do physically.
So maybe this is an answer to your question, because something happens and people work with it.
To make it
to make those undertones more mm-hmm. hearable would be to still add something over the
yes, yes, over yes,
the root notes.
Yes.
Right. So
yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think there's a the word undertone is the term undertone is used in multiple ways.
Yes.
So there we must be careful to not to confuse it. This is not the Riemann undertone mm-hmm. where you said there's an equal there's a symmetric overtone undertone symmetry mm-hmm. which yeah. is not true because we can now measure it and he himself said it's not true after yeah. all. So that's not the not the case that there's some partial notes but below
mm-hmm.
but this is purely perceptual so there's no physical
mm-hmm. as far as
to my knowledge there's no debate no. That we can measure it and it's mm-hmm. yes. there is no undertone
it's just a phenomenon you can build that and you perceive there's a stronger bass
yes perception like the double bass on the telephone mm-hmm. example
yes.
that you can recognize a double bass on the telephone but it's mm-hmm. not possible because the mm-hmm. frequencies are not mm-hmm. Audible
okay. So, thank you. So next we leave it on order. Okay. Next we play down to the deep bass region, and now what happens is that more and more of the higher frequency trail moves into the inside. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So if you build an instrument, you can start with a middle range and set the basic character. You try to make it even stable in the higher range. It will not always work. And then is another thing to go to the bass side, and then you add things in the very high partials to make it also work in the bass. If that part is not there, the instrument will disassemble in the bass, and you cannot use it musically below a certain range. And there is a kind of a breaking point, which is in the little octave, also just below the music, the melody level. There is typically a breaking point where if you just approach it, the character of the instrument either slowly or suddenly switches over to the bass character, which is set by the higher partials. As an example, I'll show you. Just a second. I've showed you the flute I built, and here we go. I use an early stage where I have just set, I've built that preset, but I have just made the first part, the basic. Can you please switch to 13, yeah. In the high range, please switch to the middle. Yes. So it's basically already the same. It should add a little bit of reverberation. Yes, so it's already the direction I was going was clear. But if you now move down through the little octave and down in the bass range, it becomes indistinctive. And deeper down, it has just a pressing quality, indistinct. You have strong room resonances, but you cannot really use it musically, and it's difficult to use such in a composition because if the music requires to go down the little octave or lower, you have problems with the instrument. And for that reason, I added some additional trickery and content in the higher range. So go to channel 3. That's the completed instrument, yes. Okay, there's still a kind of a transition. It gets a little bit more string-like character, but I just added it to make it musically viable so that you can carry on a line and put it and do not have those restrictions. So I think, and now another thing I should add to the spectral, I see my time is advancing, but I still have to add those quite fundamental stuff. So another thing is, if we have several instruments, we have now seen that we perceive a tone, but there's a whole spectrum spread to higher frequencies. And the point, a very important point, is that we perceive a tone at the musical key, which could be like to link to some frequency, but actually energy is distributed towards higher frequencies. So there is, in the physical senses, in the sonic space, is something going on in a region where you don't perceive it. You perceive it, I call it, at the grounding point. You have a complex pattern, but the pattern has a grounding point. It's a metaphor, of course. The grounding point is where the musical key is, but you walk at a different place. And that's very important for making bass instruments. You do it for a certain key, but you do your walk at a different point, at a point where you can perceive it very well, because in the middle range, our perception is way more sharper and we can follow the lines better. So we use that effect, that we perceive the combined energy and volume, which is created by that whole patterning at the grounding point. But another thing, another consequence of that insight is that if we add several instruments, even if they seem to be some octave apart, the whole trails of them overlap. The spectral trails overlap and they play together. They can create beating. So when you add several instruments, they can create beating. And another thing, if they are similar or self-similar or the partial, so that they overlap, then they melt. So you have, if you double up an octave or below, you can double up and create, put more energy in, more volume in, just by adding a line. So the instrumentalist or the musician or the performance just doesn't have to crank up the volume or play more forcibly. You add, as a composer, you add another line, and it doubles up if it fuses, and this way increases the volume without cranking any volume up. And the other takeaway from that point is that if you have instruments close together, they need to be different in spectrum, because you need to keep that patterning apart. And it's a play of what you can recognize and what you can discern at a certain level. And there's also that different sensibility in the levels, which means that basically in the middle range, in the little octave, you can have your lines very close together. You can have a line here, and you can have a line here, half octave apart. And they are separated. On the other hand, in the bass, this is so close together that the chord becomes noisy. You cannot, the acoustic nature doesn't get separated. So that's another consequence of the spectra overlapping. And I'd like to show you an example, a musical example, where this is quite stunningly used. Piece of a romantic symphony, where you can perceive that just by adding instruments, the spectrum brightens and goes up, and the musical emotion is supported by the scoring. Repeat it. The composer has added, after the first bar, he had added some additional instruments to double up, just in the way the musical movement goes. He goes with it and supports it. Thank you. by looking at that spectrum diagram, you can really see there is the foundation, the backbone, and then others are filled in, which heighten some overtones. And at the last point, the violins fill in and fill the floor level in. So that's the point. I tell you all this stuff because you need to know that if you build instruments, that is what matters. You combine the spectrums. You need to give the composer means at hand to combine instruments, to build up, to change, to shade the stuff. And you need to play your instruments together to get that quality. They don't work out by themselves. If you build an instrument, you need to tweak to make it playable in that way. So you need to play chords, you need to play movements and listen to it, how it works out. And so basically, I have covered the whole topic of spectral content now. My time is quite advanced, but I should add something which is actually more of the meat, but it's okay. I showed you the thing which I can, in an introductory workshop, show you most well, that there are phenomena at which you should look. Now, we have covered a lot of the movement of the changes of the spectra already at that point. But especially now for the practical part, we need to get that movement and the changes into the instrument. And what we do is, of course, we use the envelopes. We have envelopes, but we don't use the envelopes in that simple way of an ADSR envelope. But fortunately, in Yoshimi, we can set fine control points and really shape that envelope curve. And for that, I need to at least outline some of the, I call them dimensions, orders of magnitude, which are important if you go into shaping a transient. That's a kind of theoretical knowledge you just need to have, and it's founded in research in neurophysiology. So there are certain time windows or time constants in our hearing apparatus, and we need just to know where they are to make that stuff work right. So I call that dimensions. It's not a kind of an esoteric dimension, but it's rather order of magnitude. So the first, which I know, I think I have even in the presentation, yes, I have a slide for that. The first dimension is what I call the incidence. It's roughly about 1 millisecond, and it's when the sound appears. It's not, technically, it's not precisely the first wavefront, but the incidence starts when a sound submerges and detaches from the underground, so you can perceive it as a separate thing. That's the point where the incidence starts. And the incidence is a very, very short period. But our hearing apparatus is tuned in a way that when a sound appears, it immediately establishes a hypothesis where it is, roughly at that distance and direction, and what kind of sound it is. And so the incidence shapes very much of the way how an instrument appears when it's played. So if the incidence is sharp, or if it's soft, if it's sliding, also that makes quite a difference, and you do that in the first millisecond. Now that's really tough because the programs, the software is often not precise enough. In Yoshimi, we can go down to 0.6 milliseconds as the slowest thing. So we can set 2 or 3 notes, but at least we can do a little bit of either going in slowly or going less sharper. And another thing we can do is basically the escape hatch we can do always. We can layer several spectrum. That's a core feature of instrument building with Yoshimi or such. You build several slightly different spectra or ways of spectra, and you play them with the same MIDI key. So to show you this in the GUI, it looks this way. If we have an instrument with lot of take that reed instrument, and if we look at it, you see we have several layers here. I have three layers, and that layer, which I call hautbois, is again has six components. Has again six components, which get in. You see the curve here, with every one of that is shaped and fine-tuned. It's not finished yet. I know. I just got it to the shape that I can play it here in the lag. But so basically, they have a slightly different spectrum, a slightly different phase and coloration, and then you can fine-tune it with the way you go in. And so at least you have some possibilities how to get in sharper or slower. So that's the way you do it. And you can at least with this, you get some additional degrees of freedom to shape that incidence. And at least you need to play with it. It makes very much the difference how it feels for the musician if he plays a tone. And I think I need to get ahead of my time, so I skip what we meant to show you at that point, because I want still cover a little bit of ground and then show one or two things. And
afterwards
we can show it. Okay, so the incidence is that first millisecond, and then the next dimension which I mentioned are 20 milliseconds. It's also quite short time. From the neurophysiology, it's this way. If a new sound appears, our brain creates an hypothesis. And then it locks onto that hypothesis and doesn't take in much additional sensory data. It takes in a little bit, but only what fits into the model. And after 20 milliseconds, there is a reconsideration. Is there still something there? If the theory is confirmed at that point, then it appears as something happening. If it is not confirmed, it is just dropped as a minor event. And that defines why these are roughly the dimensions. It's not precisely 20 milliseconds, but it's roughly at that point where you start to perceive finer details. So you get the time window between the first incident and the onset, and this is where the instrument needs to take its place. This is where it grabs, where it goes from a noisy to a sonic nature. And this, I call it consonant because what you perceive here is very similar to the consonants of spoken language. So you have the t-t-t sounds or the p-p, or you have v-v-v-v sound, or you have a t sound is sharp and goes over. P sound is slightly rounded. An aspirated sound has a level and falls back a little bit. And if you add several LFO oscillations, then you are rolling. And you need to do that roughly in the first 20 milliseconds. It's just an orientation, then you can start experimenting, play the instrument, build such you have seen in my example. You have seen some forms, so you see you play with that and see how it does. So that's the consonant part, and the next dimension I call the dimension is also I want to highlight with that they are nested into each other. The incident, the consonant spans also the incident part. It's just another temporal dimension. And the vowel is up to that point where we notice that the tone is held or extended. If below that point is roughly 101, 120 milliseconds, below that point it will be percussive. If it dies out below that, it will be there, it will be a sonic event, it will have a character, it will have a coloration, but it remains percussive. And after that point, it is held sustained, and only after that point you noticed the expressivity, the volume, the changes in it. And the vowel part is where the characteristic coloration is established. That is typically the time where the formants appear of a sound. So you have first the sound takes the stage with a consonant, and then it takes the room of the coloration of the. Typically, the formants move a little bit and then get to a stationary point, which is according to the resonance of the instrument. Now, I should fill in what a formant is, because it's a bit, little bit confusing. Formant is a little bit confusing. We saw already complex spectra. Complex spectra have patternings. So they have parts which are higher and lower and so on. But as we have seen in the last demonstration, if we play it, it moves over the scale. And the difference for a formant is a formant stays at the same point in the spectrum. So that means if a formant is there, the patterning moves through the envelope of the formant. The formant stays at the same point, which means that always another partial is at the point of the formant. And that gives the very changing and colored character of an instrument. And that's a thing I should also demonstrate shortly. Do I have the time? Yes, it's so important. I should demonstrate it just with some tones. And I should... Just a second. Let it get in the kit. So I've built a basic spectrum. It's quite complex and long. That is one thing. I tweaked a lot to get it right, played it over all levels and so on. But the other thing which is there, the nice thing which you can build with Fukushimi, it has a resonance curve. It's a very high filter with very much poles, and you can basically draw that filter. So the complex spectrum, as we see it here below, moves behind, like hinter Schablon, it moves behind it, and at one time is that overtone is exaggerated, and at other time the other one is exaggerated. And in the physical world, the formants are created by resonance. There is a resonant body which widens and improves some frequencies. Can you please switch on channel number 7? Just if you play some, you have seen the resonance curve. You see, just this is always a different overtone which goes at the X. Now, how do you build such a complex curve? In that case, I used the samples of an oboe, which I played with at the beginning, to look at them and look how it works, but I didn't copy them. I just looked at them, and then I used a roughly exponential spectrum as a baseline pattern, and slightly tweaked some of the lines, and at the same time created that heightenings to get the moving character roughly in that way I didn't want to imitate an oboe, but just take some of the musical properties like that singing nasal quality in that range. It gets more trumpet like. Yes, and I want to show you at that point that you really can do a huge deal with this fine tuning. So I put in here an early stage of that same instrument. Can you please switch to channel number 13? I should add a little bit of reverberation. Yes. So here basically is the just the basic spectrum is, now I'm in the wrong level. I need to get in the kit and I need to get in that component. So there is the basic level is there, the spectrum is there, which I have built, but it's all in all one component and thus it's moving together. Even if I add a little bit of LFO or oscillation, it's still moving together. The next step, which I did, that's just an idea what you can do. Let's load the next one. So now I have broken apart that spectrum. I've walked over that spectrum and disassembled it in basically in three components. I looked at the overtones, I looked at musical examples of various instruments, how they are dancing, and I used that as a baseline to separate, just use the same baseline pattern and leave one overtone in one spectrum. You see that? Just some are there and some are left out because they are represented with the right level in another spectrum. You see, here's the remaining part. And then I even used the third part and I put it over into the PadSynth. PadSynth has a wavetable in Yoshimi, which has the same setup. And then the nice thing is with those copy and paste buttons, you can copy and paste a existing spectrum over and then shape it. And you see, I made three things which together match up to the spectrum which I've created, which the basic sound is. But now I can give them different LFOs. And especially the PadSynth has the very distinctive quality that we can widen each line and soften it. Now, please play that instrument, that variant. Yeah. Yeah. I think we should even do on channel 14, the first version. Can you switch to channel 14? That's the original version, not breaking apart. Sorry, stop. I need to get the same level of reverberation into it because otherwise it won't be comparable. So here we have quite a lot. Let's put in also quite a lot here. Roughly. I can't make it precise now, and also here. Okay, play the number 14. That's the combined. This was the combined spectrum, and now play the number 13. This was the breaking apart spectrum. It's gained a lot of quality of flexibility and moving. It's if you look at the lines. Yes, thanks. If you look at the lines now, you can see the different dancing of the lines, which are created by the different LFOs, which you can put in on the. And that's the idea. You can expand on that, and you get a huge leverage on creating and shaping an instrument this way. And finally, go to channel number 7. That's the combined instrument. So you see, that's a huge difference, and you make that just as the difference of working on the transients. The first all have the same spectral content, the same layering, the same content. The first one combined. The second step was breaking apart with several moving parts, and the huge difference is adding a little bit of LFO here and there, have transient, fine-tune everything, I will think of them. It makes just the difference, it completely have LFO, it has a singing quality. But I immediately removed that LFO so that it doesn't get kitschy. So the musician, by the way playing it, he gets the control how much of the vibrato he gets. But if you hold it, it gets straight again at the end. And of course, when you do that kind of work, you need to listen and you need to get the leveling right. You have different components, you need to listen to it to get the leveling right, so that's the unity, uniform thing. So it's basically my time is almost at the end. I wanted to show you a lot more, but I hope I could have showed you some inspirations about doing that. And I have one final demonstration, because I told you, yes. I have we can have a little bit of Q&A, but I take up like about 5 minutes now. I have one final demonstration. I talked so much about musical context. So the really thrilling thing happens if you take those instruments and make something musical with it. Create a score, play a piece with it. So I made up a piece. In the last days, I thought I need to show you instruments which I've built really in the works, in the life. So I used a little bit, at least not a composition by myself, but it's kind of arrangement, and I built on the it's a waltz. It's a waltz, but it's not a waltz of the 19th century. It reenacts the waltz character. And I used the tune, I know that piece by heart, and quite, I find it enticing and interesting. And I know it works very well on the pipe organ. So the pipe organ players kind of like that piece because it can be played on such an instrument. And there is some kind of relation to pipe organs with what I do here. Also, pipe organ is mostly shaped, and there's that kind of agogic as the organ players feel, by the way how long you press a key and how you accentuate. There's not much more expressiveness there, not much more control, but you can do a lot. And so I use that little piece. And I just want to play that piece to you. So I have used all those instruments which are here. The drums kit is, I didn't use that, and I didn't use the guitar here. But all the others are shown in action.
Thank you.
So, thank you very much. So we have left a little bit of time, am I right, for a Q&A. So if you have questions, inspirations, critique, yes, I'm very happy. So here's the microphone.
Works. One, two. Okay, okay. So yeah, I actually have several questions. Is it okay if I... So please take these questions not coming out of my cleverness, but rather ignorance. But they're going to be like kind of challenging, but that's just because I want you to really expand on the topic. So one question should be super simple from an ignoramus point of view. You were saying, oh, here are the flute plays the high notes, and then the strings play the low notes. And so, you know, the flute has this characteristic spectrum. Like to me, like an ignoramus, it's like, isn't it just because it's high notes? And if you play the low notes, it's going to be the same as string. Like the spectrum is just going to look the same as with the string. Probably not, but I want you to answer.
There is a 2 point in that, because if we go in the bass range, every instrument and every spectrum tends to be more and more string-like. And if you don't make it more string-like, you cannot use it in a musical way. So if you have the same instrument, like a flute, which is the high range, is more flute-like, if you move it in the bass range, you perceive more overtones, then it becomes more string-like. But a distinct string is still something different in the bass range, and that is due to the patterning of the string. So the overtones of a string move differently, and I didn't cover that topic so much. I wanted to cover more how you do it. A string like you in my piece, you heard some string-like instruments. You do it basically with the subtractive synth. So that is, you put in the subtractive synth, you put noise in, and you filter out the lines. And this is the way how you can build a rather string-like instrument in a synthesis. So the difference is not just the spectrum, but the way they move together. And as I said, I would say a string-like instrument is a tightly woven fabric of related patterns which kind of move together but are interwoven. So the right point is, yes, if you go in the high frequency, everything tends to go in the direction of pipe, because you have only few overtones. You have in the low, you have to lean over toward the string nature, but there are still differences.
Okay, so, yeah. Okay. So now, like the kind of the challenging questions where it borders on criticism, but not really. Yeah. So first, like the leading question, like what is your goal in the end with this? Is your goal to just emulate or orchestral?
No.
Okay, yeah.
Distinctly not. I do not want to emulate instruments, classical instruments. I never did analysis and reason thesis, but I want to build something which has, if you play it, it has qualities of a similar kind, so you can use it in a musical way to attach to that musical ways to move. And yeah, that's it. I want something which is at the same time synthetic and built from scratch, and it has that built of scratch nature that you here had a nice term, the geometric nature. You still perceive it's something built of algorithms and something. It's not an imitation, it's not injected sound or the texture which we capture from. I want to build something which is synthetic, but which has the ability to move in a way how we know it from traditional instruments.
Okay, so that's perfect, because now it leads to what I would perceive as kind of slight criticism, but rather like a push in the other direction. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that so you're showing several recordings and saying, look, in order to get this musical feeling of, you know, variation that it builds up and stuff like that, you have to combine instruments. And you said that phrase, and I wrote it down, that combining instruments is the only way. But clearly this is not the case, because you're showing us a recording which is not combined instrument, but just this one waveform. It's not combined instruments, right? It's a recording. And there are no instruments. They're just one recording. So if you have this great technology, and I was really impressed by how you're changing by just one slight lever there, you're changing the, like, this is wonderful, the characteristic of the instrument. Mm-hmm. Why can't you then think from the point of view of an approach where you don't have several instruments, but instead you're creating something that behaves like this, but being just one instrument, you know? You know what I'm saying? So if you would directly automate that, then it could do that.
I didn't really get your point.
So I'll explain, but it's a crucial point because it's a completely different kind of thinking about it. So you have right now, in order to create something like orchestral-like, you will have to create several instruments, like one flute, one string, one bass, something, whatever, mm-hmm. and then you combine them. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, why think by this kind of orchestral, traditional instruments way, where you can just create one instrument that is able to combine everything and generate a wave like that?
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
if you're recording something, it's now a wave that physically exists, and there are no different instruments, it's just one wave.
I can tell you, I think I can answer the question. That's very fundamental to my approach. I think what I am doing is a kind of building. I built an instrument. It's not a kind of designing something, so I built it. And I'm leaning towards the way I've seen how traditional instrument builder built an instrument, and when I create such a preset, it is an act of building. I have a vision, I put things in, I put time in to create spectra and to shape it. It's a journey. I start and I end somewhere. And I have limited capabilities. I have a vision and I arrive at some point and I'm surprised where I arrive. And then I do it again with another attention, another gearing. So I don't do it that approach because I'm a person and it's my work and I'm an instrument builder. And that's why I built several instruments. And the other thing, I like to compose and I like to have several instruments which I can use in a way which attaches to traditional ways, but don't imitate them, because I have that idea to carry that further. So that's the answer. I do not design something which has capabilities, so I am a builder. I use techniques to create something in the way of artwork and approach, but I also give in to what happens and what I see on that road while building those instruments. And that closes the loop.
Got it. Yeah, that answered my questions. And now really the final thing, guys, and I'm giving up the mic. The criticism is that I would object to your usage of reverb, and especially in the demo, I felt it was completely out of place, and mm-hmm. I could hardly make out what was playing mm-hmm. because there was just too much reverb.
Yes.
Like, I think you really have to work on that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yep, so.
It's not even a criticism, I know that myself. It's so to say, if you make something, I did a lot of recordings, and the mastering with reverb and anything is a lot of work. You need to put a lot of work, and this is not mastered. I was anxious to show it, even because I know it's out of place in several points. But what I wanted to show you is how those instruments interact, even if room is there. Okay? Another question?
Yeah, compared to his, this will be a hard one. So do you upload the presets so we can...
They are on the Creative Commons. Please, I final slide. Yes, thanks. You give me the... And cover this, there's the GitHub. It's only a README there, but tomorrow or so they will be in.
Yeah, thank you very much for that, for sharing.
Yeah. Another question?
Yes, the thing we put to the end, mm-hmm. It was to me very astonishing. I played the instruments in different stages and different paths, and he was working for a long time for them, month and years, mm-hmm. the listening and this. One thing for me was so new, I only knew the ADSR curve and how to shape. And then I played, and he showed me what you can do if you make a very specific curve, how it feels different in the fingers to play it. And it was very I would like to show what I perceived, because it was like, wow, what can I do? It's fundamental. I didn't know that this is possible. Can we do this? Maybe 2 minutes or three minutes.
I think the time is used up, but it's the last thing we can play off the record, so to say. I think the time is used up, or can we have? Do we? Okay, yeah. Okay, but
thanks.
Okay, any further question? Otherwise, let's do it. Okay, thank you very much and enjoy the lecture. And be sure to visit the other workshop of Will tomorrow. It's 14:30, I think. Yes. Because he will. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because if you're interested in designing sounds or something like that, to get your experiences in there, we have a Döpfer system downstairs. It's an analog modular synthesizer, and you're free to use it. Mm-hmm. If you want to, just ping me after this event, and I will show you the device. Okay, so have fun.
Okay. One more. Do we want to, everyone? Audience is listening. Yes. Okay. Then what do you want to show, especially?
We start with a simple ADSR curve, and I just play tones.
Mm-hmm.
And you start forming a specific unload.
Mm-hmm. Like okay. 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 Then let's use something rather neutral here, channel number 14. Okay, now try it. It's a single layer. No, it's not yes, it's a single layer, but it has already a curve. So we just kill everything here. So now it's an. Make it even sharper. First, I just crank up the attack, you know that all. It gets softer. Switch to this free mode and start adding elements and shifting them around. Okay? Okay, thanks.